Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foodish.
Yep.
Well, welcome to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. It's good to be back, and as usual, we've got a couple of topics under discussion, and we have a special guest, Cedric D'Souza, who is the former coach of India and is now the coach of the Austrian hockey team. And I caught up with him in Belgium, and just to talk about what it's like to be a coach of a Tier 2 nation and the problems you face in a sport like hockey, where obviously there isn't quite so much funding flashing around for people to spend money on players and fixtures, etc. But anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And John, it's great to be back with you. Obviously, we're in two different countries at the moment. I'm on the far side of the world in the UK getting ready for the Women's Hockey World Cup. But I must admit, I've watched the Football World Cup in six different countries this time around. Never done that before. But it's been, I think, a really, really good tournament in the main.
Well, I agree with you too. I think it's been one of the most enjoyable World Cups in a while. But just before we hit World Cup world, you, in your globetrotting, have been in Breda as well at the Champions Trophy, a tournament that was won by Australia, but no one seems to notice.
Well, yeah, is that going to be your topic? Do you want to go with that one first? Or?
Well, it's just come to me right now as we're speaking, so I might as well tee it off. But I would like to ask you how you found the Champions Trophy, because from a hockey player's point of view, it was fantastic hockey and looked like a great tournament.
Yeah, I thought it was actually one of the best tournaments I've ever had the privilege of commentating. I thought the standard of the hockey was phenomenal. The setup at Breda, they did a great job. They were fantastic hosts. They looked after everything. Everything was incredibly slick. And I also think credit must go to Ameline from the FIH, because she was one of the sort of event organizers. And I have to say again, of all the events I've done with the FIH, her performance was second to none. She was outstanding in making sure that everything was delivered on time when it was meant to be. So organizational wise, I thought it was superb. Hockey-wise, again, I thought it was really, really good. The pitch, there were issues, but we did have, obviously, a very hot spell there, and the pitch did seem to dry out a little bit more than normal. Penalty corner conversion rates were just so, so low. I think it was 16% conversion rate for the tournament, when normally at international tournaments it's around about 30, 32%. The other argument was that some of the teams now are just getting more aware of what teams have got to offer. I feel that maybe some were keeping something up their sleeve for the World Cup later in the year. But it was a good tournament. Pakistan, who were there, the lowest ranked team, were invited. You know, they were ranked 13, and normally it's, you know, the top six teams are competing. They were better than everybody thought. You know, they beat the Olympic champions. Roland Altman's had about a month and a half in charge of them. And you could see he'd given them a structure, he'd given them discipline defensively, and they gave everybody a very hard game. So it was encouraging to see that a great hockey nation like Pakistan weren't the whipping boys that they'd become in recent times against the top teams in the world.
And that a lot of people probably expected them to be at that tournament. They probably looked at the rankings and went, well, you know, they did win only the one game, but in every game they played, they were the, at times, the equal of their opposition, so they're not too far off it at all.
No, I mean, they just need some strikers. They didn't take their opportunities. Their strikers were a little bit shy, a little bit hesitant, and I think their attacking prowess that we've all grown used to seeing from Pakistan was just missing. I mean, if you look at the game against Australia, Australia managed to sneak a 2-1 win, and you've got to be brutally honest, Australia were lucky to get a victory in that game. They didn't really deserve it.
And, of course, another country that's not known for doing something on a hockey field, and that's defending, India, have found a way to defend. They were fantastic.
India were superb. It's very interesting, I think, and you talk to the various people around the team and around the other teams, and what they were saying is, you know, you've had the various coaches come in now, and they've all contributed in their way. By that, I'm saying the foreign coaches. You know, like Terry Walsh gave them discipline, and then of course You had Paul Van Ass, Roland Altmans, even Shad Morai in the short period he was there. The players are now exposed to so many different systems, the way they've also defend, the way they transfer from defence into attack. So they're much more savvy now, and they're much more confident against playing against other systems that other countries come up with. And there's a real belief. The great thing about Harendra Singh is he is a real team builder. He is a guy that pulls other players together, makes them believe in themselves, but he believes in them, and he gives them that opportunity to excel. And I think he's the perfect man at the perfect time at the moment. And will India win the World Cup? You know, obviously the Indian press is saying they can do it. They can do it. I still think that's maybe a step too far, but I do think that they are a genuine contender to be in amongst the medals.
And for mine, there was only one disappointing part of the whole tournament, and that was the media response to the Australian victory back here in our country, because it was virtually, it just didn't exist. Even Fox on their Fox News report in the afternoon didn't happen to mention to viewers that they would be broadcasting the final that Australia was playing at in. They got a little tiny run into some of the electronic media late on the Monday. Press, of course, it was too late played on the Sunday for us for that to reach that deadline. But even on the Tuesday, little tiny story in the corner bottom page in the West Australian, the local newspaper here, and not much else anywhere. I think the Murdoch papers carried a small AAP report. It was virtually invisible. And it's so disappointing for a team that you could probably now argue is one of the greatest that we've ever had over, what, 40 years of the continued success of the Kookaburras.
I mean, here's a question, John. I mean, whose fault is this? Is it the relationship that Hockey Australia have with the media in Australia? Because surely you would think they should be banging down the doors, and the minute it's happened, getting information to all of the TV stations, the newspapers, going, guys, we've just won our 15th Champions Trophy. It's a record. It's the last tournament. This is huge. Bang, bang, bang. Or, you know, is it again that the FIH is not doing enough to spread the word? Because, you know, to be honest, even over in this side of the world, there's been next to no coverage. You know, we've got the World Cup for women coming up in less, just over a week.
It's coming home, Ashley.
But you're not seeing very much. The interesting thing was there was a very big article where it was saying the England football team had actually looked at the penalty shootout system and the way hockey had reacted to it, the way hockey prepared the women, you know, when they won the gold medal, how they prepared for their shootouts. And football actually gave England hockey credit for them coping in the penalty shootout because they learnt from watching them. So, you know, that was a big positive, but that was the only story you've pretty much seen.
Yeah, and it's easy to understand. It's easy to understand how
responsible that.
Well, I think hockey people share some responsibility for that. I mean, even within teammates, I know people that have never been to an international game, for instance, never been to a first grade game, and that they play the game. They give up every Saturday afternoon during winter to play. So there's some, they've got some sort of investment. But the investment doesn't carry on beyond that. And I think there's a lot of people who won't buy a newspaper, not because it doesn't have a hockey story in it, but because it doesn't have something about football tipping. It's as much about the people who support the game supporting it more than as anything else.
No, it is, but it's a great shame, and you feel for the athletes who, you know, as we all know, don't get paid a great deal, and they give up so much of their time, and they are professional elite athletes in everything except for remuneration.
Oh, absolutely they are. I mean, maybe that's what keeps them grounded to a degree, which will lead us nicely into talking about the World Cup. And you've just seen, you know, one of the world's top players being lambasted publicly and humiliatingly for his antics on the ground. Yeah, that bloke's making €500,000 a week. Yeah, he's so shocked he's fallen off his wallet and and broken his back. Yeah.
Well, that was going to be my topic, but I think we'll go to our special guest first of all.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, yes, it is time now for our interview on the show. And as I mentioned, I'm still in Europe, and I caught up with a good friend of mine. I've commentated several games with him. He was the coach of India. He's now the coach of Austria. And obviously that brings up a whole set of new challenges, Austria being a tier two hockey nation. And the man I'm talking about is Cedric D'Souza. Cedric D'Souza, welcome to Not The Footy Show.
Well, thanks, Ashley. Good to see you again.
No, it's good to catch up, and obviously now having coached India and also Greece, you're now coaching Austria, which is obviously a tier two nation. But what are the challenges like as a coach of a nation where presumably you don't get the funding you get as a tier one nation?
I think there are a couple of aspects. One of the fact is that apart from funding, it's also a player base which is really small. So there are two sides to the coin. You know, when you have a smaller players, then the focus is much more individual. At the same time, people take things for granted in terms of their positions in the team. So we are trying to increase the player base and trying to get players who are in Austria to go and play in the international leagues, maybe in Germany, in Holland, Belgium, you know. So they get away from Austria and they get to play much higher hockey. So when they come back for the national team, we get a little more seasoned player. That's the question of hockey-wise. As far as funding, we get our funding basically from the government. And we're trying to get sponsors, like every other team in the world. And we make do with what we can in terms of what we have and what we can try and procure. And in the end, the most important thing is to not say what we don't have, is to utilize what we have to the best of our capacity.
Have you found it a really interesting challenge?
Definitely. It's when I took on this job in 2016, the only focus was 2020 in terms of trying to get into the Olympics. And many of the players are in the international leagues playing in Germany and Holland and Belgium. And we are trying our level is best to try and get into the Olympics, which is, I think, for many players who are of repute. To name a few is definitely Benny Stanzel and Mickey Kerper. And of course, Zava Hasana, he's not that old, but he's still a youngster who's playing abroad. So from that perspective, we know this is really a good opportunity to try and crack it open. But it's also a very, very tough tournament. So the first, the HFI actually started their Hockey World Series, which is round one, which we just finished playing in Zagreb. And effectively, we won that. So the next one is sometime next year. We presume it's Malaysia. Sometime FIH says May, June. It's going to be difficult, a challenge for us because you have the European leagues going on at the same time. So it's going to be, we're hoping it's not April, May, you know, it could be in June. Then the leagues are over and we can have our full strength. Otherwise, it's going to be really toughy because it's after the World Series round two and then you play the qualifier in the end of October, November next year.
That was going to be one of my questions. It's all very well wanting your players to play in the top leagues to get that experience, but then you face the problem that the clubs may not release them at a time when you might need them.
Well, I think there's an unwritten code, which is that if they're required for the national team, they play for the national team. But at the same time, you can't go onto a path of confrontation. You've got to keep it a balanced thing because the players have to earn money too. And if they're getting money, then you've got to make sure they're happy and content with the club and happy and content with the national team also. So it's a fine balance. It's to be able to find a compromise between the clubs and the national team and get the best of the player in both scenarios. So at times, yes, we went to Zagreb with 10 players who were not available because some of the injuries and some of the exams, because June was a difficult period for us. So we were marking buttons as to how many we would lose out. And this is the nature of the game. You can't help it. If it's done this way, you then compromise with whatever you have and do the best of your ability.
I mean, I presume there's no way you can compensate the players financially when they leave their clubs because you wouldn't have the budget for that, I would think.
And there's no way the Federation can pay that kind of money. There's no way. So we have to find ways within the clubs, talking to the club coaches and explain to them the scenario and things like that. But if it comes to a Final Four between the club and a thing, then it becomes the player, it becomes really very difficult. Fortunately, we haven't had that problem yet. But he'll may have to cross it in the future. And then it means really putting on your thinking cap and trying to find a way that everybody is happy.
One thing we have to mention is obviously Austria won the Indoor World Championships, which is a huge achievement. I mean, we see Iran who've said that's their focus because they're going to struggle at 11-a-side, but it sounds like you're very much focused still on the 11-a-side.
Well, definitely. I think, let's be very honest about Austria is number one in the world today in the indoors, and what they did in last year, or this year, sorry, in the European Championships and the indoor was phenomenal. That's the only word I can look at. To win both, to beat Germany in Germany when the packed house is there, I mean, it's incredible. And to be number one in the world does give, the government does give you funding, which is then used for the outdoor season. But if you look at it, the indoor season is a very small season compared to the entire calendar year of hockey. So more emphasis is put on to the outdoor, although we are more successful in indoor. So yes, my focus is, I'm not an indoor coach, I'm an outdoor coach. So basically my whole focus is the outdoor. And the Federation backs us on both, which is good.
Is there a crossover, though? Do you believe that, obviously, indoor players can then make the transition to outdoor and that the skill set you learn from indoor is beneficial to outdoor?
Well, you know, there are not many countries in the world which have segregation of players. So apart from Germany plays both. Their players in indoor and outdoor. We do the same. So I think Belgium doesn't. And I think the Netherlands don't. But apart from that, you have the same players who play both sports. So there's... There are two sides of the coin again. The one is they don't get an arrest because it's going on continuously. They play for the clubs, they play for the country, they play for the country again for the indoors, and then they go back to the clubs for the outdoors. So the time frame for them to really get a put the legs up and let the hair down is really, really short. But, you know, that's the nature of what it is today. And from that perspective, I think Austria does ride piggyback to a certain extent on the indoor success.
What is it? Does it get publicity? Obviously, that success, did you get media coverage back in Austria? And does that help the growth of the game?
Well, I think what happened was there was a huge, not a hue and cry, but it was great to hear everybody was talking about Austria, and especially the kids in Vienna. And from that perspective, we got a sponsor. Skoda came in immediately. And I think that's the first step towards the future. The question is, you win one, is how do you maintain it in the next one? That is the most difficult portion. So the focus now is completely outdoor. I wasn't there during the indoors. I was not in minus 14 degrees. I was back in India in the warmth. So that from that perspective, I think the important thing to understand is what I can read is the fact that we did very well in indoor. It will be a focus when it's an indoor season, but when it's the outdoor season, the focus is also outdoor.
And where do you see the future? Can Austria become a viable sort of competitive nation against the countries you mentioned, like Belgium, the Netherlands, maybe in time, or Germany?
Well, let's take a leaf out of the football book. Okay, we're just seeing the World Cup going on this moment, and Iran drawing with Portugal 1-1. I mean, South Korea beating Germany. I mean, smaller nations are getting stronger. The question is, in hockey, the funding is the big thing. The funding is there's a huge disparity between the top nations and the second tier nations. There's a huge disparity. And until you get successful, sponsors don't come in. The question of success comes in if sponsors come in earlier so that you can get your matches. So we are kind of starved when you compare it to the elite nations, as we want to call them, getting their matches right through the year. So Germany plays 40, 50 matches a year. We play 10. So it's different. So whatever it is, I think within the constraints that we have, I think what is happening with the team is remarkable. And yes, we could go all the way. The question is, it's going to be a hard grind.
I would presume as well that one of the challenges you face, again, as a second-tier nation when that funding isn't there, is that you don't have the money then to focus on coaching at a junior level so that the basics are learnt very early, so that maybe you're playing a little bit of catch-up when players get into their teens?
I think the thing is also to have... We have an under-16, we have an under-14 now, 14, 16, 18, 21, and the men's. So there is a certain amount of effort put into the youth system. Austria has qualified both in the youth for the Youth Olympics. The girls and boys have both gone in, so that shows that we are right in the right track in terms of our development stages. The issue is to keep on wooing more children to come to play hockey. You know, it's difficult when there's no funding in terms of propagating the sport and making it much, much higher to what it is.
So how important are the Stanzels and Corpers that they succeed in those European leagues so that they can be almost held up as examples of the possibilities if you work hard?
Oh, well, 1,000% very, very, very critical for Austrian hockey. And the pulling of players and wooing of players into our sport, that is very, very important for us. I think they are kind of very, very strong figures, figureheads who promote the sport in Austria. And they are critical for the future.
Now, as I mentioned, you've coached India. I would think this is just so completely removed from what you would have experienced as a coach of such a hockey-loving nation then.
Well, I think, you know, you wear different hats. I'm at a different stage of my life now. It's I love what I do. That's why I'm at it for so many years. But the question is, you know, you don't think of what you don't have. It's always focus on what you have and work with that and hope that you can achieve the targets that you set for yourself and the team sets and the federation sets for you.
And, of course, there's a lot of hope that India, after their performance in the Champions Trophy, could get on the podium at the World Cup. I'm sure you'll be rooting for them. Do you believe they can?
I think, you know, if you look at where the graph of the last 5 years of India has really shot in the right direction, it's going all the way up. And if you look at it today, they used to leak goals quite often. But now they structure the defense well. They play the national flair up front. So it's a blend of both. And I think they found the right balance. And I really believe they can do very well in this World Cup. I think the medal is on the cards.
And how important was the Hockey India League in that development? Because suddenly it seemed those players didn't fear the Europeans or the Australians.
The change in Indian hockey came in not only with the coaching staff that came from abroad, as well as the Hockey India League. The Hockey India League was the biggest bonus and the biggest uplifting of Indian hockey. Because you got the youngsters, especially the younger boys who had the fear psychosis, was completely removed because they played against with and against the elite players of the world who were within their teammates. So they just said, oh, they're same like us, you know, the kind of thing. So they had a lot of interaction and all these fears have all been eradicated now. And they can look at you in the eyes and match the world today. So the Hockey India League was really the turning point for me also.
Well, Cedric, always good to catch up with you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Ashley. It's always good to catch up with you. Hopefully, we'll work to do some commentary together soon.
This is Gary Lineker, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
And that was Cedric D'Souza, the coach of the Austrian hockey team. And hopefully you found that interesting about, you know, how difficult and the challenges he faces in bringing up the next generation, getting fixtures and hoping that they can compete against the Tier 1 nations and maybe even get a spot at a World Cup or, you know, even an Olympic Games. But the thing, John, I think that's interesting as well is how Austria has excelled at the indoor game. And to me, I think that's a really important factor because if you want to start somewhere, I think that's not a bad place to start. You get your players playing indoor, that will grow the game with success there, and then hopefully that will produce players that you can then put on the outside pitches and really excel there as well.
I'd have to say I agree with you, Ashley. I mean, that opens up whole other discussions about Pro League and what hockey's doing with 11 aside and 9 aside and blah, 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 and there's lots of feeling that maybe they should just leave it alone. There's 11 aside and there's indoor. There's two ways to play the game and that's it, and just concentrate all our attention there. But as I say, it's a much bigger argument, and he's got a good hockey person, Cedric.
Oh, he is indeed. He loves the game, and he said this may well be his last gig before he retires because he's not getting any younger, but he's absolutely loving the challenge there in Austria. And I must admit, I watched their under-21s play against Belgium, and they played really, really well. And the only thing really that was the difference, and they were a much smaller team because he had a lot younger players. He had a lot of 16, 17, 18-year-olds playing. Physically, they were smaller, but they just lacked that belief and that confidence. And had they shown a little bit more composure and maybe believed in themselves a little bit more, they could have got a result in that game.
I think that you and Cedric should buy a little caravan and tour around Europe commentating hockey games.
Hey, you wouldn't get... I'd love to do that. I don't know whether the wife would like it, though.
We should move on. Your topic.
We should indeed. Well, yeah, I wanted to touch on, as you mentioned before the interview, I think it's been a brilliant football World Cup. Russia's done a fantastic job. It's been hosted well. The coverage overall, I think, has been brilliant. I think the VAR has been fantastic when you compare how horrific it was in the A-League, and it's been a real surprise to me as to how that's been. But FIFA really have to walk away from this World Cup, in my opinion, and look at this diving malarkey, and they've got to get rid of it. Now, we saw Marco van Basten, I think it was at the end of last year, you know, the former Dutch great, saying that they needed to look at the rules of hockey and adapt some of those rules. Say, for example, giving a green card. So if a guy dies, well, then maybe you send him off for a couple of minutes and the VAR can look at it. I'm not sure that that's going to be enough. I think you need to suspend these guys for, say, two games or something like that, so that teams actually really suffer and coaches start taking responsibility and saying, we are not going to dive because I need my players out there. Something drastic has to happen, because Neymar has become the laughingstock of the game. There is no doubt about that. The amount of video clips that have been created about him, it's embarrassing, and hopefully he sits there and feels that he's made himself look an absolute dick, because to me that is what he's done. I mean, he's the highest paid player, or one of the highest paid players in the world, and he looks an absolute con man and a complete joke. But just before I let you say your thoughts, John, those Van Basten rules, interestingly enough, I found out, are being trialled at the moment in a lower league competition in the Netherlands. So they are trying a kick-in rather than a throw-in in football. They're also trialling the green cards, and they're also trialling a shootout if the game finishes in a draw. So it's going to be interesting, the findings from FIFA on that. I don't think you'll see FIFA making massive changes, because one of the keys to the success of the game of football is they've kept it simple for over 100 years. The changes have been minimal, and the only player that really has been penalised, and I'm a bit personal about this one, is the goalkeeper, because the rules on that always keep changing, but everyone else seems to be able to just do what they like.
Well, I agree with you that the VAR has ended up being a success. I think they improved their decision-making as the tournament went on, and I don't think that the penalty they paid against Australia in the game against France, they may not necessarily have paid that towards the end of the tournament. And there was a couple there where I thought that they allowed play to go on. The referee had allowed play to go on. And when you looked at it back in the replay, you know what? There was probably technically a foul there, but the player he was playing for the foul. There was no way that that player, had he not been fouled, would have gone on into a position to have scored a goal, because he kicked the ball 10 feet in front of him. And I think that sort of decision making is going to help make those sorts of systems a success. And it's any system like that that you introduce into a major sport the first time, you're going to have teething problems. I think their biggest problems was getting used to what the decision should actually be, given the information they're given, not technical issues.
No, I agree with you there. And I think the other thing that's important in all sports where you use video technologies, I think you have to see it as well in real time. You can't always just see it in slow motion, because slow motion gives you a very different impression of the action as it happens in real time. Now, unfortunately, players don't move in slow motion unless they're playing Masters or something like that. But
hang on. You brought up an interesting topic with the cards, though. Now, in hockey, for instance, we have a three-card system. So you've got your green card, 2 minutes, mate, just chill out for a sec. You've said a naughty word or whatever. You got your yellow card, which is traditionally 5 minutes, for doing something you really shouldn't have, and probably meaning to, and then the red card is a send-off offence. But when you look at football, it's interesting that once you get inside the penalty area where you can give away a penalty, there's either nothing happened or the worst thing you could have done happened. There's no middle tier penalty for a player that, say, goes in for a tackle and in a situation where he should legitimately be allowed to tackle and just gives a minor clip. He's not doing something, what's the word for it, deliberately. And it's a fair play and all the rest of it, except he's just slightly clipped the guy. He hasn't run in and grappled the fella and thrown him on the ground, as we see so much of. But referees have no in between to call it. It's either play on or it's a penalty. There's no, in hockey we have a circle, so we would have a short corner for just a minor infringement. Whereas in football, they go straight to the penalty for any sort of infringement by the opposition inside that area. I wonder how they can go implementing some change there that would make the penalty less of a penalty, so to speak, for the defensive team.
Well, that's always been the thing, hasn't it, that you almost get a triple whammy, because if a player gets a red card for the offence inside the penalty box, so he's the last man, prevents a goal-scoring opportunity, he would get a straight red card. Then they get a penalty and they score. So it's like you get almost this triple penalty for one offence. It's a really difficult one. I can't see that being changed that much. What I do worry about from this World Cup is you've seen players getting yellow cards and they mean absolutely nothing. Like, they are deliberately at the end of the game slowing the momentum, trying to break up play and literally committing professional fouls, taking a yellow card for the team just to kill time so that they can hang on to a victory. Now, that to me is more of a problem at the moment, because it shows a complete disregard for the rules, for the spirit of the game. Okay, it's professionalism, people tell you. You've got to learn to win. But I think as a fan, it's the most frustrating thing. It's the most annoying thing. And it's insightful to the opposition fans that this guy just blatantly breaks up play, takes a yellow card and just shrugs his shoulders and walks back and gets on with the game. So I think they need to look at that one as well. But the diving is the thing that's the most detrimental to me in the whole game.
One other thing I don't like, and I know that this time, I'm assuming this time I'm about to talk about is accounted for when they add extra time on, but if you've been substituted, get off. Just get off the ground, mate. They stand there, couple of deep breaths, slowly trudge to the sideline. Just get off the field. Guess what? The coach doesn't want to see you anymore, so we don't either. Get the next bloke on there.
Well, the French against Belgium, that was one of the worst, where the player walked across to the other side of the pitch, when his number came up. Then he strolled off. Then he shook hands with all his teammates. The referee ran across and said to him, "Get the hell off the pitch." And he shook his hand and said, "Thank you very much for the game, referee." Oh. It was almost like he was expecting someone to come on and give him a bouquet of flowers. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, you've been substituted. That means get off. And
yeah, I think maybe you need to have a time limit in which, if you're not off in that time limit, then, basically you get a card or... Look, I don't think you want to make it too officious, but they've got to clamp down on these things because they do spoil the game as a viewer and a fan.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's about... Well, standard of football, I think it's been one of the most attacking World Cups I've seen for a little while.
Certainly it's been one of the most that I've enjoyed, so looking forward to maybe the one in Qatar. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, but it's not coming home, sadly.
It's not indeed, but... Anyway, should still be a World Cup to be proud of for the English, and certainly that's the feeling in the country over here, that their team did better than they expected. But what they've done is instilled pride in that, the way they performed, the way they carried themselves. There were no egos in that team. They were a team, and that's why they were successful, and hopefully Gareth Southgate can continue that.
And we shouldn't forget another country who've done a tremendous job, and that is Russia. In hosting it, that seems like everything's been going very smoothly over there, and everybody seems to be enjoying it, players, fans, everyone.
Absolutely, and congratulations to Russia. There were a lot of us that were concerned about it initially, but they've done a fantastic job. And I think a lot of people have come back saying, what a great country. So that's another good thing for them.
I think that's about all we have time for this time around, Ashley. But before we go, we do have to just ask you about the upcoming Vitality Women's World Cup. Something is coming home to England, and that's a Hockey World Cup. And you'll be there doing some commentary work for BT Sport. I'm looking forward to the tournament. I think it should be fantastic.
I think it'll be a great tournament. I mean, they've made the Lee Valley Hockey Stadium bigger than normal. They've put in extra seats for it. All of the England games are sold out. The final is sold out already. And I think maybe the semis. I'm not sure 100% on the semi-final. So great that the British public are getting behind it. I think the fact that the football team did well, the public overall in this country is going to get behind it if they get that, as we were talking about, the media coverage they need to sort of get the public behind it. But I still think it's going to be tough for England to take away the gold. My money's on the Netherlands and Argentina. I think they're the two teams to watch in this tournament. Of course, Australia have got a really tough group to get out of as well. That's going to be a challenge for them, I think.
Yeah, I don't think we can be marking down Australia for a finals pace, unfortunately, at this one. You're probably right. The Netherlands, it's almost like it's theirs to lose. The Argentinians will be there. And I'm throwing in a dark horse, my mate Andrew Wilson, with the Spanish team. So look, let's wait and see how they go. And my favourite...
My dark horse is the Black Sticks. New Zealand Black Sticks, they are a team to watch out for.
And if you want to watch out for a player, watch out for Gigi Oliver. She is a little rocket.
I watched her actually at the Champions Trophy. They were having a Four Nations series. She is quite a feisty player.
She is. Great to talk to you again, Ash.
Always good to catch up.
See ya. We'll be back next week.